The podcast you are about to listen to discusses comic books and comic book related media. Be warned, the following will review art, plot, and themes, and will therefore contain spoilers of the materials discussed. Welcome to Comics League International.
This is Brent and Lydia talk
Starman.
Keep it together. Keep it together. We're doing good.
Good. Very good.
And, you know, this is our 30th episode.
No.
Yeah, this will be 30 episodes up. I'm pretty pleased with this output. I'm happy.
Yay! Congratulations, us.
And in this episode 30, we're going to be talking about Starman Volume 2, issue number 27. Yeah, and it has a cover date of February 97.
Ooh.
All kinds of numbers going on here.
So many sevens.
Lucky sevens, hey!
Yeah.
Nice. So I looked up a few things that happened in February of 97. Ooh. And there's some interesting stuff, or at least to me. So the movie Schindler's List.
Oh!
Yeah, it came out in 93, but it was February 97 when NBC, kind of a major network in America for our international listeners and probably co-hosts, they aired in primetime, they aired Schindler's List completely uncensored.
Ooh, okay.
You know, which normally when they show even big movies, they make sure to take out any foul language or, you know, nudity or anything like that that may be too intense, but Schindler's List was deemed such an artful movie that it was shown together. And I remember it being on at the time, and I want to say it was even shown without commercial break.
Okay.
And all of those things are very rare for network.
Wow, okay. I didn't know that. No, I've never watched the movie. I've only read the book.
It's a very powerful movie that I keep saying I need to watch again as an adult, but just haven't had the time to watch it, where I also just knew that it's going to make me cry. It just
will. Yeah. You know, it was very hard for me to finish the book. I'm actually quite a fast reader, but Schindler's List took me about 8 months to finish because I had to put it down.
Yeah.
At certain points, because it wasn't graphic, I think, not the book, but just the depictions of tragedy and, I don't know, it just caused a lot of silent emotional outrage for me, you know? It's just very, very, it was just very hard to read.
No, I understand. I've never read that. I once found, like, in the middle of the street during my college years, I found a copy of, you know, I forget the name of the book, but the author was Primo Levi, and he wrote about, the book may even be called, like, Surviving Auschwitz, but it was about his experiences there, and it was a very, you know, it's a very thin book, and yet I never made it through it, you know, partly because, well, you're in college, and every week you're just given, like, read these books. So reading something that you want to read is of course, a lot. But also because, you know, every three pages were just so emotionally taxing. Which, you know, complaining about someone's memoirs of life in Auschwitz being emotionally taxing feels very nasty, but I hope people, you know, understand, like, it's so heavy. But we're gonna move along from that heaviness to other movie news that happened in February of 97, and that is the Empire Strikes Back special edition premiered.
Ooh, okay.
So, you know, and this, I think Empire Strikes Back less so, but the special editions do kind of have their own detractors for kind of adding in a lot of extra CGI and adding in a few extra scenes. I heard less complaints about Empire Strikes Back than I did about A New Hope. But, you know, these kind of signaled the end of being able to easily find and watch the original theatrical editions of Star Wars. I don't know. Are you a Star Wars fan?
I'm not. Not in a way that I have ill feelings towards it, but because I've never watched any of the films. But it's crept into popular culture and the lives of my friends enough for me to catch the references.
I think at some point you, because it sounded like you said you didn't watch it, and, you know, all I heard was white noise, of course. But I think you should watch the original trilogy if you get a chance. Outside of that, you know, I mean, I'm not saying you'll love them, but kind of like the same way that if someone says, I've never seen Citizen Kane, it's like, wow, that's kind of an important cinema thing. Maybe you should watch that.
I've not watched that either.
Oh, Lydia. I'm moving on to talk about Dolly the Sheep.
Dolly the Sheep.
Do you know Dolly the Sheep?
Not really. Really? I might have heard of it. Yeah.
Dolly the Sheep was the world's first cloned mammal.
Okay, right.
From an adult cell. And it was announced by the Roslin Institute in Scotland. And this also happened February 97. And, you know, the sad thing about the way, at least my brain works, is here's this great scientific breakthrough of cloning animals. And yet, the main thing I remember is within a few months of Dolly the Sheep being announced, Little Caesars Pizza put a commercial out where, you know, they had scientists in a room and they hit a button and poof, smoke. And where there was one sheep, there was two sheeps. And then they're like, wow, amazing. And then another scientist runs into the room with pizza being like, hey, look, you can get two pizzas for the price of one. And he throws the box of pizzas on the button that is the sheep cloning button. And then proceeds to just, like, for emphasis, bang the pizzas. And in the background, you get more smoke and sheep and sheep and sheep and sheep. And that's basically what I remember about Dolly the Sheep, is it made a little... It inspired a great pizza commercial.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah. What's that? Great scientific achievement. No. Pizza. Pizza.
I see. I've never watched that commercial, but I presume I was only 8 at this time, 8 or maybe 9. And but I remember something from back then, which was in church. They were like up in arms about it because, oh, these scientists are playing God. and I was like, huh. I don't know. I don't think they're playing God, but I mean, that's another debate. But
yeah,
but I do think that it's fascinating, and it could save a lot of lives if cloning was actually a thing. But now I think they haven't really gotten, what do you call it, like with the iPS and stuff like that. It's still not stable, right? The technology and the science behind. Using all these cells, which is actually kind of a pity, because I really do think if we could regenerate certain cells, it could really help save a lot of lives. I mean, we're not talking, I don't think, you know, why I don't think it's playing God is because it's not talking about immortality, but it's more of like, you know, prolonging life for the sake of living life. Yeah, so...
Yeah, like, I mean, I can definitely see how the idea of cloning brings up a lot of uncomfortable questions, you know, and a lot of, like, what is right, in a way. Mm. But at the same time, I think there are so many uses for cloning and for that type of research.
Yeah.
Especially because, you know, in my mind, cloning and stem cell, I know they're different, don't get me wrong, but somehow they kind of fall under the same controversial science umbrella.
Yeah.
And I think there's so many uses, so many avenues for research before the, wait a minute, is this the right path, really starts to open up.
Mm-mm-mm.
You know.
And you know, about the, just a disclaimer to all you guys out there listening, I actually am on the side of science, even though I consider myself a religious person.
Mm-hmm.
And religion and science are not on opposing sides of the spectrum. Actually, there are a lot of scientists who are able to reconcile scientific concepts with religion.
Yeah.
And that's actually a really interesting thing that I think people kind of overlook.
Yes.
Right? And just putting it out there that it exists, this idea that religion and science can coexist or even, you know, work in harmony. It exists. So, you know.
No. And I mean, I grew up in a very traditionally religious way. You know, I mean, we went to church every Sunday. Right now, like, I honestly don't know where I fall on the spectrum of religion. It's definitely part of my culture, but I don't know where my beliefs fall. Not to really open that up, but just to kind of say where I'm coming from. And yet, you know, I mean, so I knew some incredibly open-minded and science-friendly, you know, Southern Christians, as well as some not so open-minded. and you know, whenever I it always annoys me. Both groups of people annoy me. Those who assume that just because someone is Christian, that they somehow have, you know, they react to science like the Wicked Witch in the Oz movies, where they just any bit of science melts them. And I also get super annoyed with the religious representative, let's call them, who do seem to react to any bit of science as like, oh, you are making blah, 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 blah. Because it doesn't really matter what words they're saying at that point. They're just spewing nonsense. And it's like, oh my goodness. Do you know how many people are going to take your craziness and paint every Christian person with a brush?
Well,
you know, this one really loud person said it, so obviously it must be true for everyone.
Thank you though for saying that. It comforts me that not everyone is ready to paint us with a brush.
but I mean, like I said, who knows how much of that is because, like I said, I grew up in that environment, so I got to see both sides. I really got to see, you know, one of the great little youth group discussions I remember having was basically in South Georgia, the youth leaders kind of bringing up the idea of like, hey, you know, maybe this whole created the earth in 7 days thing, maybe that's more of a metaphor. Who says it can't be evolution and creator inspired at the same time? You know?
Yeah.
Which at that time was kind of like, whoa, someone's actually talking about this? Mind blowing. But you know, it's out there. People who try and reconcile belief and science.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. In many ways I think Starman is also a very scientific piece of work. So I am excited to, you know, encounter all these, you know, science and fiction and stuff like that through what, all these like 100 episodes? How many do we have?
If we go the whole way, it'll be a total of 111 at least.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Starman actually inspires me a lot when it comes to my writing as well, because I found out that I actually write science fiction. I hadn't realized that I've been writing science fiction my whole life. It's quite interesting. So, just to put it out there, yeah.
I did want to mention one more quick thing. You know, honestly, okay. I can't remember if we talked about this in a past episode or not, but O.J. Simpson.
Oh, yes.
Yes. In February of 97, he was found liable in the deaths of Ron Goldman and Nicole Simpson in a civil court suit.
Mm-hmm.
So he was, earlier he was found not guilty of their murder, but in this civil court action, he was found liable. And honestly, you know, one of the main reasons I did want to bring this up was because in the past month or so, I watched the 7-hour documentary.
Okay.
OJ Made in America.
Oh.
That really traces OJ Simpson's kind of start as a athlete up through kind of present day and how it intersects with race relations in America, and I guess you could almost say specifically in the California area, but certainly America falls into that. And it's, you know, the idea of a 7-hour documentary was daunting, and yet it was incredibly well made, very, very, educational, illuminating. And I would definitely say if someone wants to learn more about this, about O.J. Simpson, about race relations in America, I think that documentary would be a valuable watch.
Okay. It's, what's it called? The documentary?
It was O.J., then I think colon, Made in America.
Okay. Right. Check that out.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for sharing.
Thank you for listening.
Yeah. So, I guess it's my turn now?
Yay!
Okay. I'm a bit late for this issue, or maybe early, depending on, you know, whether your glass is half empty or half full. But it's actually, Starman 27 is actually a Christmas issue. And so, it's Christmas, and the Odairs are having a big family gathering, and Jack is invited. But he's late, and we find out why as the scene cuts to him getting ready for the party. He has to get champagne and raspberries and stuff like that. And the poor thing's already delayed because he watched a Christmas movie that plays every year and stuff like that. But yes, he's like trying to cross the city, and then he meets Santa! Except it's not really Santa, but a down-and-out homeless guy who was part-timing for a department store, ringing the bell as their Santa. And this Santa, his name is Pete. Pete is upset because he was robbed of his locket, which is like his only, I wouldn't say, like, I guess it was his only worthwhile possession. It was the thing that he was hanging on to because his wife and son, who were killed in a car accident, their picture was inside the locket. But he got robbed of it, and so Jack takes pity on him, and then he brings Pete on a bit of an action adventure across the city to get his locket back. So even though he's late for the party. Okay, so meanwhile, the Odairs are welcoming guests like Ted and Mikael / Michael. And then we see Charity, who's Ted's other plus one. And Mason being all happy to see her, even though he was all awkward about inviting her. And then there's this like cute joke that actually I did some foreshadowing about with Hope and Charity. But we'll talk about that later. And then the Shade arrives, uninvited, to deliver something. It's actually a book. And he's asked to stay by Matt, but he doesn't. And we also find out that, I think, Matt He isn't on the greatest of terms with his family until today, right? And just as everyone's getting impatient over Jack's tardiness, he shows up with Pete, who has Lockett, and together everyone celebrates Christmas. It's an exciting, amazing, heartwarming episode that I really, really liked.
Yes. I liked it too.
Yes. Good. Because I thought it was kind of like a nice, like a breather from all the drama.
Yes, yes. No. Yeah. No, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but no, it was, it comfortably straddled that line of being very sentimental without being like glurgy type, you know, like, oh, yeah. Without being cloyingly sweet.
Yeah, I think it was funny that, I don't know, that Jack was so bent on punishing the bad guys. Yeah, but I mean, he probably didn't have to use his superpowers, his super rod and everything. He just could have just like gone up to them and said, "Hey, give him back the locker." it was very gratuitous where we had the fighting scene.
So. Well, let's hold on to that discussion.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
Procedure, Lydia.
I'm sorry, but it's Christmas.
So what did you think about the cover?
I did not like read too much into it. I was like, oh, it's Christmas, but now as I look at it, they're looking so sad. And cute effect with the rot being the star.
Being
Starman, you know, it's like tongue in cheek. What's that phrase? Art imitates life or something like that, right? What is it?
Yeah.
That art imitates life, imitates life. Yeah.
You know, there's something like, I don't know what it is about this cover. I mean, I really like it. I like the holly. I like that it both somehow, it's like the way Starman is written is what just different enough where it feels special. Like that slight curve to it, but it still stands out. So it really feels like the special Christmas issue, and also feels like almost like a, I'm gonna mess up the name. Norman Rockwell has that very Norman Rockwell type feeling to it, of like, you know, the old painted family scenes.
I need to Google Norman Rockwell.
Oh yeah, he's like considered just to be like a classic American artist of just like scenes of family and people hanging around, like, you know, little boy goes to the whatchamajig parlor.
Fun fact.
Yes.
I was impressed that you knew that this was holly, because because a lot of people would mistake it for mistletoe.
No, it's not mistletoe. Right now I can't place it in my mind since it's been so long since I've seen it, but I know that is not. It looks very, very different.
Yeah, you know, that was what I was puzzled about, because for my part, in my part of the world, there's no holly or mistletoe. Huh. So I had to Google it, and holly is, it looks like this, on the cover of Starman, and mistletoe, it doesn't have these like jagged edges on the leaves.
Yeah.
And the berries are white.
Yes. I couldn't remember if the leaves were partially white or the berries were white, but I knew there was white in it.
Yeah, because of the whole, you know, depiction of people kissing under mistletoe, and sometimes it's actually holly in the pictures. Yeah, but it's not. It's a mistletoe. It doesn't look like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Should we go inside the cover?
Yes.
Yes.
Go. Let's go.
And I guess we'll get to it, but immediately where we can see that, wait a minute, this isn't Tony Harris. Should we wait till we name the artist, or should we go ahead and kind of discuss his art style now, you think?
Oh, we could discuss his art style.
I really like it.
Me too. I thought it was very clean. I don't know whether that's a good way to say it.
No, it was clean, yes.
Yeah. I knew it was different. Yeah.
It was very clean, and yet, also, I think one of the things we've both really liked about Tony Harris's art is that he's very good at depicting facial expressions and emotion in it. And I think our artist this issue, I'll go ahead and give it away, Steve Yoel, I think it's pronounced, is just as good as really making the characters emote.
I think so too. Yeah. I don't know what it is, though. It might be the... I feel like there isn't a shape to features. Like, he uses lines in a way that... It's not outlining the features, but it just sort of, like, pushes them into prominence with the thickness and the... Like, a dot here or a stroke, a tiny stroke there. It just changes the entire thing.
Yeah. I mean, and the
face.
The way all the elements come together here between the inking, the coloring, and the penciling, it does feel kind of like just a perfect combination.
Yeah.
That, you know, it doesn't feel overdone. No one ever feels plasticky. They always feel real, even if it is kind of almost sparingly done.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so first two pages, are we going to talk about them?
Yeah, I mean, I really like that flirty nature of Clarence and Faith's relationship.
Yes. Yeah, they're such a... You know, they've been married for a long time, but they get along so well. Yeah. It's a bit different from the other couple. What's their name? Wesley and Diane...
Yes.
Yeah, they've known each other a long time as well, but these two, Faith and Clarence, they're very in love, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird. I didn't even think of those two couples together. But it's now that you bring it up, like, yeah, there's something about the Wesley and Diane feeling of a very much a partnership.
Yeah.
Whereas I would say, like, this one, like you said, it's more of an in love feeling. Even if there doesn't seem to be so much of an active partnership in their relationship, that in love really shouts out.
Yeah. Maybe Wesley and Dan, they're in love with each other, but they more like love each other than they are in love with each other.
No, that makes sense.
Right? Yeah. Well, this one, they are in love with each other. It's cute.
It is cute. Even how, like, the scene kind of opens up with almost like an overdoneness and, like, are we going to keep talking about this?
Yeah.
And she's like, yeah.
Yeah, they justify it because, like, they're role-playing or something.
Yeah.
It's so funny. It's like, I mean, okay, to put this in perspective, if these were your parents and then you were looking into the conversation, it will send shivers up your spine.
Oh, you know, I mean, like, seeing as how we've recently been classified as a clean podcast on iTunes, I don't know how in-depth we can get to it, but the double entendre of the eating the fig pudding.
I know.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Like, what? Yeah. Yowza. That's... You're having guests over soon.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think if I heard my parents being that blatant with it, they would have been like, oh my god, I don't...
Like, ooh.
I've got to leave the room. I don't... Yeah. I understand that you two have sexual relations, but can we draw the line?
Yeah, it's very cute. I think it's a very ideal relationship for people who are married. Yeah,
and I want to check with you because for me, like, I liked how they had that kind of overblown role play darkness to it. And then I kind of felt like, I'm looking at page two, once Faith has her line of, when are they coming? Like, it almost felt like there was a click, and now they're speaking how they normally speak.
Yeah.
I really got to admire just the skill of Robinson for being able to, with just a simple line, turn on and turn off their acting.
Yeah, that's good writing there. Yeah. Agreed. Completely. I really loved the entire scene. So
yes, it's so cute. Art
writing. Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it also does the heavy lifting of here's what you need to know if you're just picking up this issue. You know it's a holiday scene. You know guests are coming over. You get a sense of who is coming and who isn't. And that this is very much a family and friends gathering. All that exposition is in here, and yet it's done in just a very skillful, natural way.
Yep. Conversation, guys. Yeah, the power of dialogue. You know, sometimes I think a lot of people who write aren't that keen to write dialogue. Right? But I feel like, you know, if you're afraid of writing dialogue, go read some comic books.
Yes.
All right? It's very artful. Yeah.
Yeah, because it can... I mean, admittedly, sometimes they say, like, depending on the era of comics you're reading, comic book dialogue may not feel so natural. But I think in this book, you get lots of natural stuff. And, I mean, even just to continue to the third page where this little scene ends, here we're kind of told about Jack... the kind of person he normally dates.
Right.
And that we, sorry, I'm still on medication.
It's okay.
That Faith and Jack haven't actually met.
It's, but, and we also pick up that Clarence talks to his wife about a lot of things. And that's an important thing to remember.
Yes.
She probably knows Jack as a character in Clarence's life, but not in person. Yeah. So she has all these like preconceived notions, which may be good or bad. Yeah. But she gets to meet him, like, eventually. But before we go there, we find Jack rushing across Opal to get to the house. I think he's using his rod.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, if you could fly, wouldn't you?
I don't know. What does it take for me to fly, you know?
Like, a basically high science quasi-magic rod that absorbs energy from the moon and stars.
Okay.
And, you know, just lets you fly around.
Does it keep me warm, though? Because it's, like, snowing. And,
well,
I don't know how I think about these things. Maybe, I mean, if I could fly without taxing my body, I definitely would. But if I'm exposed to the elements, yes.
You know, I think it keeps him, if he's comfortable flying at those heights with just, I mean, sometimes you see him going up in just, like, a t-shirt. But he's also comfortable even in winter with just, like, a leather jacket when there's snow coming around. I'm going to say it gives him a little bit of warmth. I mean, if it protects him from bullets, I think we can say it can keep him comfortable.
Good point. Okay.
This I'll is Tech that. Minute with Brenda.
Okay. So, he is... I'm at page four where Jack is looking at the Santa.
Oh, yeah. What a...
Yeah, what a great very image. Nice perspective. Yeah, great picture, that's right.
And that's where we find out that this issue is called Christmas Night. Mm-hmm. And it is brought to you by James Robinson Writer, Steve Yowell Guest Pencils, Wade Von Grobiger Inks, Pat Garahy Colors, Oakley NJQ Letters, Chuck Kim Assistant Editor, Archie Goodman Editor, Jack Knight created by James Robinson, and they left off the Tony Harris this time. I wonder if that was just a little miss on their part? Maybe some resizing?
Maybe.
Because normally it is created by James Robinson and Tony Harris. Maybe. We'll find out if this continues next issue. Dun, dun, dun. Yeah.
But Tony Harris's name is on the cover. Oh.
Yes. We did have a change in a colorist this issue.
Mm-hmm.
From our normal colors of Greg Wright, it's now Pat Garahy. And I thought the colors looked a little different this issue. They're still good, and they fit Steve Yowell's pencils very, very nicely.
Yeah. There's one of my favorite pictures in this issue, but I will talk about it later.
Ooh, excellent.
That really stood out for me with the colors and the art together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so this page 4, I think, what really struck me was how the perspective suddenly changed from ours to Jack's.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so it's like we are looking in the kitchen, and then we're looking in at Jack flying over Opal, and then suddenly we're looking at Pete from Jack's perspective, and that was really special. And just like bam, one photo of him like that was really cool.
Yes, very nice.
Yeah. It's almost photojournalism in a way, you know, it's just like one of those succinct
pictures. I didn't think of that, but what a great way of putting it.
Yay.
Then when we flip the page, we go back to our kind of normal storytelling method, and we got Jack and Pete Santa just talking about what's he so sad about.
Yeah. Can we just talk about like Pete's eyes on this page? I love the golden brown syrup color. Is it called hazel? Is this color called hazel?
I think hazel has a touch more green in it, but... You know, I also feel like I don't know my colors as well as I should when it gets into, like, hazel and fuchsia.
Okay. I'm eating a biscuit, so. I'm sorry, I'm just really hungry right now. Okay.
Well, it's all that talk about, you know, Christmas dinner. You're going to get hungry.
Yeah, and by the way, I'm eating shortbread, so it's very fitting.
It is. It's very Christmassy.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, do go on.
So, now, if I have one qualm with this issue, it would be that there is, like, such a dollop of tragedy right here. Like, I'm a homeless guy whose family's all gone, and I only have one memento of my former family, and all my clothes have been thrown away. Then I got robbed, and it's not that any of it is necessarily unrealistic, especially in a world where a guy can fly with a magic wand. but it. You know, just to put it out there, since we are kind of aiming to critically read these, when it's all laid here in like one page, it does kind of feel like, wow, that's very, I don't know.
Excessive?
excessive. Yes, I think excessive is the word. It feels a little much. I don't think it hurts the overall story. It works quite nicely in the end, but just in the moment, it is kind of like, geez, like, why don't you also have like a grandchild somewhere that he also needs to support by making money off of being Santa, like this, you know, Tiny Tim back home as well. Like, it did feel a little much.
I see.
But like I said,
maybe the list was longer and they just left out the incurable disease and You never know. This might be the watered down version.
There's an unedited version somewhere.
But you know what? It's one of those. Because, okay, I grew up watching Asian dramas and.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, they have the sob stories. Very. Like, excessive is an understatement. So, yes, when I was reading, maybe because I'm Asian, I was like, oh, poor thing.
So, I think when comparing the tragedy in this guy's life to the tragedy any random character in any Japanese drama will have on a regular basis is pretty low. He would also have the flu or cancer at the same time. Like, once they got him out of the snow at this point, he'd be like, I'm so happy, and then suddenly collapse, and we cut to a voiceover of Jack being like, and then he died 2 weeks later. Like, but I learned a lesson about couponing. Like, something completely unrelated.
Yeah. But to come back, putting it in perspective, I do get what you mean by it being excessive, okay? But, I don't know. I think I felt that it really made me sympathize with him. So while I see it from your point of view, I do appreciate that it was so tragic, because I think also Jack isn't the kind of guy who's a natural softy. I'm not sure. Mm. I'm not sure whether he is one, but judging from how he's been acting for the past 27 issues, 26 issues. He's got a kind of cavalier attitude towards life and stuff like that, you know, like how he's afraid of getting old and how he wants to, like, die a hero, that kind of thing. So
I think we could definitely agree that regardless of whether or not he is a softie, he certainly does not want to be seen as a softie.
I think we could without a doubt say. Yeah, so I think he needed sort of Pete to be really depressed or, down and out for him to go so far to get that locket back. If Pete was just, you know, I'm hungry, and Jack would maybe just give him money, but not to go all out to find that locket and just bring him... You know, like how the story ended,
Now, here's a question for you. Do you think, when you say that Jack needed that, do you mean that as a, in kind of the Jack is a real person and that's what he needs to get involved, or to kind of parse it a little bit, and this may be parsing it too much, but Jack as a creation... and a creation needing motivation in a story, that was the motivation that was needed for Jack as a construct to realistically take action and still be acting in character.
Right, I think I'm leaning more towards the latter. Yeah, because that was what I was thinking as well. Yeah, definitely more, because I don't know, maybe you and I, we write, right? So we make characters, so we get it.
I don't know if you guys
out there listening, whether they get what we're trying to say.
I mean, now I totally get what you say. I was wondering, which way is she saying? Is she saying Jack is a construct, or Jack is a, air quote, real person? And I gotcha.
Yeah, but maybe a little bit of both, you know, like... If we were Jack's friend and he came to us and say, hey, you know, I did this over Christmas, and we're like, really?
And he's like, well, he was a... Okay, I said, oh, wow, we're already 45 minutes into it, and we're only on page 5.
Okay.
We should go a little quicker.
Yeah, let's move on, move on.
Mm. So we kind of get the sob story here, and yeah, we did kind of finish the next page, and just, I mean, really... with the next page of Jack and Santa, just again, great art.
Yeah, very romantic in a way. I don't know why. Maybe it's the snow and stuff like that. But I really like how the color of the Santa costume and the beard sort of like
blend in a way.
Yeah. What was that word? Like the fluffy bits.
I know what you mean, but I can't get the bat off my shoulder for the word. The trim.
Okay, that settles it. Okay. Alright, do we want to go on to the next page?
Let's go on to the next page as we have the O'Dares one by one coming in, and we get just that little character establishing moment of them and also kind of where they fit into the family.
Yeah. I love how Faith is like the big sister. I mean, she literally is, considering she is the big sister-in-law. Mm-hmm. But I like how she really interacts with each of the siblings and knows what's going on in their lives. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she talks about like she knows what's going on in Mason's life and
does her best to keep up with what's going on in Barry's soap opera of a life.
What's her name? Hope, right? Sister's Hope, right? Okay, Hope. She's like, she did what she wanted to do in the past issue.
Yes,
right. That one. Then she knows. No, she might not have told Faith earlier, but Hope is just like all excited.
Mm-hmm.
I like how there's this like immediate confiding in Faith. Right? You know, I did this. Like, it's a very like girly thing. I think I don't know. Yeah.
And I mean, I really just love the fact that there's that kind of continuity of her saying, like, maybe I'll read French or maybe I'll start taking French lessons. And then he's like, I'm dating my French tutor. It's like, you know, it's just a little, it's a blink and you'll miss it, but there it is, a connection.
Yeah.
Mm. Next page.
Yes. Yeah. Eating again.
Well, then I'll kind of take the spear on this one and say, like, yeah, we get Jack and Santa kind of hunting down the leads of who robbed them. And let's see. Oh, we didn't talk about it earlier. Like the guy who was ugly, like he was wearing a monster mask.
Right, that was the guy who stole the locket from him.
Yes.
Yeah, I think we need to establish, I didn't talk about this in my synopsis, but the action adventure part that I mentioned is basically Jack and Pete, you know, going around to, I guess, what you call the homeless bunkers. I don't know whether that's a good way to say it, but where all these homeless people congregate, and like they go around there trying to find out where the people who took the locket are.
Yeah. Almost so like a detective story. And here we have Jack kind of, you know, I feel like saying a bribe is almost too harsh in this situation, but you know, he offers $20 but he gives 40 we kind of get to see Jack being generous, and you know, possibly because he feels bad, possibly because it's Christmas, and possibly just because, you know, part of him, the superhero in him, wants to do something that can help.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, he is a good person. Again, like what you said, doesn't like to be seen as a softie.
Yeah.
So he's got kind of like air around him over here, even, where he's like, you know, I don't know, he's just kind of standoffish in a way. I don't know.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Now, I'll admit that right here at the bottom of the page where they mention, like, the other guy was ugly, like he was wearing a monster mask. My first thought was like, ooh, is Grundy gonna come back?
Oh, huh. I didn't think about it.
I had that thought.
I didn't think of that, but yeah. I mean, interesting.
We'll find out if he did.
Okay. So we turn the page. Turn the page? Okay.
Yes.
Mason's back with presents.
Hi, Mason.
Yeah. And I made a mistake just now. I said Faith knows what's going on in Mason's life, but that it was actually Barry. And you said, like, yeah, the soap opera life. Mm-hmm. And so over here, Mason's like, Clarence is like, I thought you were going to be late, and he like changed my mind, and then we find out that, oh, it's because he was like wanting to ask Charity out, but he didn't.
And Stupid boy. And those facial expressions for him, just that, like, you can tell he's beating himself up, but there's also that little bit of, like, I'm not good enough type of thing to him.
Yeah.
I mean, of course the words help, but those facial expressions really sell it.
Yeah. And Faith's expression in the oh part, that picture
surprise.
I like the face too. I don't know, there's something about the eyebrows.
Yeah.
That makes the O very pronounced. I don't know. I really like that. I like that bit.
Mm. And then, I mean, just to go back to Faith, on that last panel, you could see that, like, she's going back into hostess mode.
Mm. With that, like, smirk.
Of like, well, can't let him dwell on this too much. We got to get things joyous.
Yeah. And I like that little bit there where Barry O'Day, you leave that cake frosting alone.
Yeah.
Barry's such a child. I didn't notice it at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. And then we turn page.
On the next page, you know, we've had a few pictures like this before, but I do kind of like how when we get Jack and Pete walking, it is in the snow and there's really no backgrounds. Whether or not this is because they're kind of in, you know, the less building part of the city, or because it's just kind of meant to show they're kind of in isolation. But I think it really works to make it feel like they're on a journey, more so than if there had been like full backgrounds in the panel, like, oh, they're just on the sidewalk, like here. You know, to me, it makes it feel like it's more of a struggle to get to where they're going when we don't get to see where they are.
Right. Agreed. Yeah. It didn't strike me as that, but now that you mention it, I didn't notice that there was nothing behind them. Yeah, but I like how you could kind of get that from how the previous page was about the party, and then now it was like, you can like literally hear the wind howling with the way that the snow, or what do you call that, sleet, and it was pelting down on them. Yeah, I really got that feeling. And it's amazing how it's just one page and two pictures.
Yes.
Yeah.
And yet it really sets the atmosphere.
Yeah, it does.
Especially with the dialogue of the, I imagine you've places to be. Oh, yeah.
I know, right? Yeah. I don't know, that really stabbed me in the heart for some reason with Pete. It's like when you're relying on a stranger for kindness and yet you feel guilty at doing that, and yet you know that it's a stranger being genuine and you don't want to discount that, you know? Yeah, I don't know why, I just kind of felt for him there. Yeah. Okay, so do we turn the page?
Let's turn the page.
Yeah, we're at the party again.
And nice. Here... Oh, go ahead, please, sorry.
I know, I'm just going to say nice party scene, because it's like that. There's more people arriving, who are the Odeus, yes. And it's actually Ted.
Yeah. Ted and Michael McCall.
And
Charity.
Yeah, that voice. Yeah, and last issue I was like, it's so interesting how they are all these like attribute names with Hope and Charity. And then over here we have like Faith laughing, ha ha ha. And she goes like, my name's Faith, we have Hope over there, and now the trio's complete. And I couldn't help but think, no, there's more than a trio, because there's Prudence, and there's Patience, and there's like a host of other attribute names.
Yeah, but Faith, Hope, and Charity are kind of the big three.
That's true.
You know, I mean, it's, and then you got cousins, you know, like, there's Prudence.
Yeah. And there's
and I mean, even in the old song, like, three is the magic number. They specifically mention Faith and Hope and Charity. They don't mention Prudence, and three is the magic number.
I don't know that song. Is that a song?
Yeah, it was a Schoolhouse Rock song from the 70s. Blind Melon does a great cover of it if you want to use your YouTube later.
Okay. Check that, guys. For you guys who don't like, for those out there who aren't as schooled, who are as unschooled as I am. Check that out.
Interesting little thing. Her Faith, well, interesting to me, Faith's ha 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 panel almost looks like a cartoon version of my mother-in-law.
Really?
The way she laughs and kind of holds, like, closes her eyes and holds her hand up to her face.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, all I'm saying, if someone did this and said, hey, may age her up a little bit in the comic, but, like, yeah, there you go.
Huh.
What do you think of that Mason face?
I know, because, interesting thing, he has his eyes closed, I think, and I like how he looks, like, shy and pleased at the same time, and you can just tell that. You can just tell his emotions from his face.
He looks like a pleased little boy.
He does. He does. Yeah. What does it say, though? Oh, yeah. Well, he must have, like, I don't know. He didn't go to her place and, like, pace in front of the door or anything. He must have just, like, sat somewhere and, like, I'm not gonna do this. And then he didn't. Yeah.
And then when we change the page, we get them kind of wondering, like, where's Jack? You know, they don't really know yet. And on our panel with the four O'Dares, all the kind of redheaded ones, again, I was just really pleased. With the work Steve Yowell is doing here, because we have, you know, three red-haired white guys and their sister, and yet, to me in this panel, each one of them is very distinguishable. And I mean, there is some design element, but there also is just the way they are drawn close enough so you can tell their family, but different enough so there's no question of who's who. And that's really, to me, notable.
Yeah. I know what you mean. I wonder, though, why the artist didn't include Mason in the picture.
To me, I think in a way it's almost the blocking of the scene. You know, we get those kind of together, but also to kind of show that Mason is a little bit more standoffish. What was kind of how I took it, and also so that way we can have those two panels at the end of our two little starting to be lovebirds, Charity and Mason. Just like, hey.
Yeah. Hello, Mason. Hello, Charity. Yep.
Hee hee.
Interesting pairing, though. I mean, I wouldn't have thought of these two together until last issue. Okay.
Next page.
And this is the time where I say again how Jack doesn't need to resort to this kind of violence to get things out of people, because I bet people know who Starman is. All you have to do is see that rod and then you probably talk.
Yeah.
I don't know. But he does it anyway. And I do think that this is a point where we kind of see Jack's character where he's still very hot-headed and he's very bent on, like, finding justice for people.
Yeah.
So that's him.
But we also get him with passing out the 150.
Yep.
That he's trying to do what he can to help, and he's not really interested in taking this guy to jail. I think it does kind of show the two aspects of his character.
Okay, cool. This page, by the way, is about Jack and Pete trying to find out more information about where the locket is. So they're almost there.
And, you know, there's got to be something about the remorse that I'm going to go ahead and say is genuine on behalf of the one homeless guy. You know, who's kind of crying that he did it because he was hungry, but then he didn't, ended up not getting anything anyway.
It also paints a picture about how real and how upsetting and how tragic it all is, you know. Well,
another thing that comes in on this page is we get kind of more description on our monster.
Right.
You know, big ugly guy, and he's, you know, he's got a really weird face, but he's got a crab hand. And we've got these things like, "Ooh, what kind of a, you know, mutant tough guy is this?" And it's that. Admittedly, once I said crab hand, I went like, it's probably not Grundy. I don't think Grundy has." So I kind of tossed that aside. But you know, still figuring like, what kind of monster is this gonna be?
Dun dun dun. But then before we find out, we get cut to the party again.
Look who it is!
It's the Shade!
Yay!
Yes! He's always, like, coming by to give people things at the most opportune of moments. And here, it's Christmas time! So he decides to give... Who does he give it to?
I mean, Hope ends up holding it, but it's kind of unclear as to who the gift is really for. It seems like it's for the whole O'Dares.
Yeah. It's like your first edition of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, and it's signed by him, and it's worth a fortune.
Yeah.
So, I think it also bears testament to one of those things like, oh, here's the Shade, and this is what he can do, and he has all these things, and he's kind of immortal, and he knew Charles Dickens in person, along with Oscar Wilde and everybody else.
And you know, I like how after the "it's worth the fortune," how we also kind of get that, like, him tutting it with, like, it's Christmas. You shouldn't think of the value of the gifts on Christmas. You know, tomorrow maybe, but not on Christmas.
Nice tie-in though with the Shade and his penchant for books and. Yeah, how he's always seeming to be about these lovely tomes.
Yeah.
You know, it was first giving Jack his journals, and now he's giving these people Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, and then that field trip. Do you remember that issue where he was in the field trip with all those kids?
Yes, telling the stories.
Yeah, so it's very interesting to see a character like this.
Well, and it's also interesting that he gave the book where we had the little kind of, I don't know if it'd be strong enough to call it foreshadowing, but with Face mentioning how Dickensian the story is, and here they are getting the Charles Dickens Christmas Carol.
Yeah, definitely. Very meta.
A nice little like, oh, wow, they will appreciate this.
And interestingly, again, back to the story, Faith, she invites the Shade to stay.
Yes, because she's the good hostess.
Yeah. And, I don't know, I can't help but feel like, you know, maybe at the beginning of this story, I mean the Starman story, not this issue, the Starman story, people wouldn't have associated the Shade with, like, a welcome guest at a Christmas party, but... Now he is, because he was in the thing, the poster with Matt, right? And Matt even calls him buddy.
Yeah, they get that little moment that kind of lets you know, like, there is something a little bit more to their relationship.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when you've been through something like that, when you've been through hell, literally. Yeah. So that's a nice relationship. I always like friendship in stories. Platonic friendship, yeah.
Yes.
Flipping
the page.
Yes, next.
Now, one thing I liked is there's been the little bit of seeds of like, oh, this is, you know, a monster and a crab man. Where, I mean, when we look at the big dude with the purple bandana on, you know, I mean, it he doesn't really look too special in, like, the comic book world, you know?
Yeah.
There's no reason to believe this guy has superpowers. It could just be someone who had, like, for whatever reason, some birth defects. And his, you know, crab hand just looks to be like a simple hand where the fingers for whatever reason are kind of fused. You know, someone that you could very much find in our world and kind of think, depending on when and where he was born, just based on appearance alone, would have a much tougher time of finding a future than someone, you know, who does not look like that.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. We realize that actually, in fact, it mimics real life, I guess, again, because people like that, they not very educated, you know, they resort to this for their livelihood and violence and stuff like that, and it actually is very grievous because, like, the pawnbroker in this scene, he's hurt and he's dying.
Yeah.
Right? So, it's awful, I think. These things actually really happen. So, anyway, in this story, Jack comes to save the day.
Yes, he does.
And he gets them knocked out. And he calls them, I'm moving on to the next page, he calls them bad boys. That was kind of funny for me. Like, the villains, in a sense, but you guys are bad boys.
Bad boys. What you gonna do?
What you gonna do? Is that a reference?
Yes, to the kind of bad boys, bad boys. What you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you, bad
boys? Right. I thought I'd heard of that, yeah. Okay.
Now, is this, like, this the violence here that you've been kind of warming up to talk about?
Yes. Like, you know, zapping people. Yeah. Didn't have to. Maybe he had to. I don't know. I mean, he didn't know how dangerous they were at the point. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think there's a couple of ways to look at it. I think one of them is, you know, kind of the outside of the story of it is a superhero comic, for better or worse. Yeah. And there is a certain level of action expected in the tale.
Yeah.
I also think that, you know, we got to kind of think of what exactly are Jack's powers. And even though at times he's been able to use the staff to help kind of ward himself from bullets, he's also been shot. He's by no means bulletproof. So having one, maybe even the other guy, also has a gun, wanting to make sure they're down and stay down, you know, is probably in Jack's best interest. So I don't know. It didn't really shout out to me, for anything too out of line of taking on random thugs, but definitely please, if you have insight.
No, I mean, I think it's like what you said, but about how it's how we kind of expect the action. Yeah, I mean, it's fine, it's not like he killed them or anything, so it's fine. Yeah,
I mean, I think if it had been more grievous harm, I would definitely kind of shift more towards, yeah, maybe that was unnecessary, but it doesn't seem like he did anything permanent.
Mm. Yeah.
But you know who really saved the day?
Who?
Who really saved the day would be Santa Pete!
Yes! Yeah, he did. Hmm. He was a medic in Korea.
Mm.
Korean War. So, that was a surprise. And yeah. He helped the pawnbroker to... he resuscitated the pawnbroker. That's it. Yeah, so that was very cool. And, we turn the page.
Mm.
Okay, and we turn the page and we find out that he got the locket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Saved the life, got the locket. Yeah. And, you know, tells him at the very end of the page, that's when we finally learn Santa has a name. Until then, he has been Santa. But
yes, that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been calling him Pete, but actually in the story it doesn't come out until now.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I like that moment that, I'll admit, there were definitely a few times where I kind of got that, like, choke up of emotion thing. Mm. And I definitely had that wave of when Jack's like, so the doc said the pawnbreaker would have died if not for you. You're a hero. There was a little bit like, ooh, that got me right there.
Yeah, I get what you mean. Mm. Yeah, it's one of those things, huh? Where someone like the underdog comes up and does something great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really like the next page.
Oh, it's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, this is what I've been saving up for the past hour or so, about the art and the inking.
Yes.
Right? The last bit at the bottom, rectangle at the bottom has a close-up of Jack's face, and the way the shading is performed, it's like, you see, like, there's tension in one side of his cheek, and the eyes and the blue, a
little bit of white underneath that the tears are about to brim over.
Yeah, I really like that. I don't know, the art here was astounding. The entire page, I mean, it felt like a movie.
It really did, and just, I mean, those three panels together, and just, I mean, such simple things. Like not only the positioning of the snowfall, so it's kind of at an angle to kind of give the hint of falling as well as wind, but then to go from the scarf mostly straight down, and then that middle panel to it being, you know, hard to the Jack's left, really give the sense of that wind picking up.
Yeah. And the direction of his eyes in the last panel. The direction where the artist chose to put them in. I think that's genius! I don't know why! I can't pinpoint why it feels right to have him look up like that.
That's very, really, really well done. Very emotional.
Yeah. Brilliant! Okay, shall we go back to the party?
Yes, we shall, where it's warm and there's family and joy.
Yeah, and Michael's drinking what looks like wine. Yeah, and we also see that they're just complaining about Jack.
I will say that this is one of those things where I do kind of think Ted should have been a bit more forgiving and a bit more understanding of why Jack would be late. Like, I kind of feel if he had been the one saying, like, well, you know, he is a superhero, sometimes you're late. Like, I feel that would have worked. Like, I see why you'd want the one closest to Jack and his father kind of being like, where is he? But he's also the only one in the room. You know, arguably, maybe McCall as well, but Ted certainly has had superhero experiences and is the one who in earlier issues brought up the whole, like, Well, if there's one thing I've learned, it's that weirdness finds you.
Mm-mm-mm.
You know, true. You know, just putting that out there. Just putting that out there.
Yep. Agreed. Yeah, totally. And, but everything turns for the better when... Yes. Ding dong! Aww. And then everyone's in that scene, in that panel. Everyone's there, and Jack. Mm-hmm. And then the door opens, and it's Jack with Pete.
Mm-hmm. And Pete is looking kind of shy and out of place, and with the hands together, like, I don't really know if I should be here.
Yeah, and the stammering, and he goes, hello, I'm Pete. Mm-hmm. And you can just hear his voice when he does that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, okay, I'm just going to, like, barrel.
Do it.
The next page, yeah. So, Jack's, like, again, his cavalier fashion, introducing Pete. Oh, no, that's my friend. Hi, huh? And it's, like, his words are always hiding something, you know? There's, like, it belies, like, a deeper emotion for Jack. And I think the Odeurs pick up on it. That's why Clarence has that dedicated panel to himself in the middle. As Clarence is like, oh yeah, I get what you mean. I know what you're saying. That's why Clarence just steps forward and says, was like, he was a veteran as well, right? And then because Pete is introduced as a veteran, and Clarence is like trying to find immediate common ground with him and being welcoming and such, and so like, happy Christmas, buddy, and that's what Clarence says. And immediately, I think it helps Pete warm up a little, because you know, you want someone to feel, someone like Pete to feel like they don't stick out like a sore thumb, you know. So to say that you and I, we are on equal footing on it about like, with this aspect of our lives, yes. I think that's very important. Yeah.
No, I mean, I'm right there with you, and I also like. One of the ways I took that pause of Clarence is also, you know, not only what's behind Jack's words, but I think Clarence also has that kind of trained police insight.
Right, into
knowing that, like, you know, he probably, if not knows, highly suspects that, well, here probably is someone who's homeless. Here is definitely someone who is down on their luck, and who's kind of being an outsider being brought in. And, you know, to me, there's kind of a measuring up of who this person is, as well as what kind of a person Clarence wants himself to be.
Right.
In that same panel. And then to just kind of go in and with the big smile, be like, hey, you know, you're a veteran, we're a veteran, happy Christmas. It's just that click of like, this is what that season is supposed to be about. It's about supposed to be opening the house and welcoming others in, even if they are not someone who normally you would come into contact with.
Right. Yeah, true, exactly. And I loved how it was Clarence who said to Pete when he was crying, no tears, not tonight. Yeah, it was very heartwarming to have Clarence be the one to deliver that line.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, a real welcome. It was, this is Clarence's home. And I would imagine that, you know, maybe Pete would have something like that when his wife and son were still alive, when he was a businessman. You know, this is, you see, they are probably quite well-to-do, I guess. I don't know. I mean, you look at the place and then there's... Well, they're not poor people, that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, they're certainly, they're not, they have enough money to be able to not, to have this many people over for a dinner.
Yeah.
Without seeming to struggle with it.
Yeah, and I think that's, I'm trying to put myself in Pete's shoes and be like, that person who doesn't have the means for this anymore, and to be here as a member of this little group at this point in time, I think that's that must mean a lot, you know.
And not, you know, and especially to just highlight that aspect of someone who, of all the things he's lost, what really seems to be his breaking point was having lost family. And then to be welcomed into a family, even, you know, even if only for an evening.
Right.
Part of something here has got to be powerful.
Yeah, exactly.
Got a little tear, not gonna lie. Got one.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the byproducts of me living so far away from my, you know, main family, I guess.
Yeah.
Is when anyone, even a commercial, plays that, like, family card just right, chokes me up a little bit.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
What you gonna do?
Yeah, I know. For me, it's not that strong because, not that I don't like my family, but we were never particularly loving, if you get what I mean.
I was really worried you're going to put me in an awkward position by saying, you know, because I'm Asian, as you've past.
Oh, no, I don't think this is an Asian thing, really. it's really just a very isolated, this is Lydia's family thing. We're very close. We chat on those WhatsApp things very frequently, but it's not like one of those gathering things where you just exchange goodwill, you know? It's not a... There isn't a time where we all come together and say nice things about everyone. There was never something like that. And not a lot of affirmation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that kind of thing. It's just very different. It's a very different culture. I mean, obviously, it has to do with culture as well, but it was also a large part to do with family. So, you know, I don't really... The family card doesn't really get me. But the friendship card really does.
Yes.
Because that's where a lot of my comfort comes from. Friends whom I've left behind in Singapore. So to see things like how Jet reached out to Pete, that really got me. So very nice. Really like this issue. I like how actually it promotes goodwill and helping a stranger.
Yes.
Family. I think it's because we live in Japan right now, and I always tell people, you know, I always tell my students and my friends, Japanese friends, that in Singapore, and I bet where you're from as well, Christmas isn't about hanging out with your significant other. It's really about family. And right,
whether family by birth or family by choice, if that makes sense, it is about getting together with those who are important to you.
Correct. Same for me, because I was very involved in church during Christmas. I mean, even now I am in the Japanese church, but more of like back in Singapore. It wasn't really a family thing, but it was more of like being around all these people whom I knew and I loved. And I used to be a caroler, so I would go to different houses to sing during Christmas. Yeah, so that was it was very important for me. You know, but like to participate in something that was giving back and stuff like that. Yeah, you don't really have a lot of that here in Japan.
No. Right?
Yeah, that was a bit sad for me.
No, there's, you know, some things in Japan that are fantastic, and then there are other things that do kind of make it hard to get into seasons for one reason or another.
That's right. Being
intentionally vague, because if I start now, I'll never stop.
Yeah, and we should wrap up.
We should, and again, I really just want to congratulate this issue, because I do think that to have a comic cover this kind of themes and family, in a 23 page story, 22 page story, I think in weaker hands, all around, it could really run the risk of just kind of feeling like, in a very special episode, Jack goes and finds a homeless veteran. Oh, they have a wacky adventure and then have turkey.
Like, yeah.
But this felt very, you know, very impactful. And in 22 pages of funny book story, I think that's really an achievement.
Mm-mm-mm. Yeah.
Speaking of achievements, where can they find you on the interweb?
You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook, all at the URL extension Quick Channel, Q-U-E-K Channel. And my handle's the same for all of these platforms, so you're welcome to follow me. Oh, and recently I've been Snapchatting a bit too, so yeah. How about you, Brent?
You can find me on Twitter, at Dead Troubadour. You can find my main website, deadlytroubadour.com. And, you know, if you really want to help me out, you can go over to Patreon, which is patreon.com. And if you go to /Brent Thomas, you can help me, you know, pay for hosting and give me a little tip for not only this and other podcasts, but just for doing some daily writings on that deadlytroubadour.com. Yeah, and you know, while you're at all that stuff, if you really have a moment, we would both love it if you could go to our iTunes page, Brent and Lydia Talk Starman, and click that button to give us a star or five, haha. Or, you know, even just leaving a review. We are very, very much starved for reviews, and we need y'all to help spread the word.
Yep, that's right. Please do it, you guys.
Please. And next week, we are going to be talking about issue number 28 of Starman. Ooh, yes. And I remember this one. This one's a good one.
Okay.
Haven't read it. You. It's okay. A secret.
Okay, secret. Okay.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. There's a Starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a Starman waiting in the sky. He's told us not to blow it, 'cause he knows it's all worthwhile. He told me, let the children lose it, let the children use it, let all the children boogie.